So last week, there was I went over a poem, and it really is kind of driving a lot of what I'm going to be saying this month. I Stand by the Door, and the point of the poem is that the author is saying he's not going to delve deeply into the house of God and write some great essays on what it means to be a person of faith or who God is and what his nature is. He's not going to come up with some masterpiece of worship, and that's not going to be his life. His life is going to be the guy at the door, whose purpose is to put one lost soul's hand on the latch, and it's the door that leads to God, and that's what his life is to be about. And it's something that the leadership team at church has been talking about for a while, about how we want to be more outreach-oriented, and they're going to be talking about that over the next couple of weeks, and so you're going to hear more and more about that, and that's really what's driving me using that as the image for this And the theme for the next week or so. And our example last week was the Samaritan woman at Sychar, the woman at the well, and how her whole message was just, I met Jesus, and this is what happened. And because of that message, an entire town believed. A town that just minutes before she wouldn't even look at, and now they all believe. There's no telling how many people are in heaven because of that woman's testimony. So this week I want to explore a different gospel narrative, a different experience. So if you could turn to Acts 17, we're going to be reading out of Paul's sermon in Athens. So you've probably heard this. Maybe you're not even aware of how it's referenced. So at the point of this, as we go through, you can maybe look at some of the things before the text. So Paul's had a really rough time. He was imprisoned in Philippi. He finally gets out and he goes to Thessalonica. So in Thessalonica, he's trying to help start a church and get some believers, and his enemies stir up a riot, arrest his friends. They can't find Paul at the time. He and his companions have to sneak out of town at night. They flee to Berea, the next town over. And then not long after they're there, same thing happens. His enemies come from Thessalonica. They're following him around. They're pursuing him. He has to flee. This time he has to go alone. He leaves Silas and Timothy behind. They're going to come later, but he's in Athens now, and he's alone. So we start in 17, starting in verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. Athens was really known for its religious nature. There were over 30 temples and places of worship in the city, and you couldn't really go anywhere without seeing an idol, an inscription, a dedication, something dedicated to the gods. And these people were known all over the ancient world as the most religious city and the most religious people, not necessarily moral, but religious people on the planet. So that was the reputation. Paul sees it, and something inside of him makes him feel kind of sick. He's got this visceral reaction in his gut that this is wrong. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So Athens at this point was the center of philosophy in the ancient world. So if you had a son and you were from a wealthy, prominent family, it's almost guaranteed that you would send your son to Athens for at least a period of years, like going to university, so that he could be educated in the philosophy of the time. So this is where Socrates, or for those Bill and Ted fans, anyone? Socrates? No one? I'm really showing my age. Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, that's where these guys all were from. And really what happened, and just real quickly, I'm not going to explain much about Epicureanism or Stoicism, and I probably couldn't even if I had to, but basically the result of it was Aristotle and Plato, two of the smartest men who ever lived, kind of and one was the teacher of the other, but they really disagreed on the nature of reality and truth and the existence, the meaning of existence. And so the reaction was, and these guys were like 600, 500 BC, so we're talking hundreds of years later, people still haven't sorted out what those two guys said. And so instead, what they basically said is if Aristotle and Plato don't agree on the nature of existence and truth, and it's kind of hopeless. So instead, they developed these really cynical philosophies, and Epicureanism was really, if it feels good, it is good. And that was, the whole point of it was just to be free from suffering or pain. So if it feels good, it must be good, therefore do it. Now, they weren't complete hedons, and you know, they wouldn't give themselves over to passionate lust. That wasn't okay, because that would also lead to problems. So that would cause suffering. So their thought was to be at peace, to kind of separate yourself from anything that was too extreme. But if it feels good, it must be good, be free from pain. The Stoics, on the other hand, they also rejected the passions and the great opinions and the debates. They were more in the line of just it's about reason. That was their great altar upon which they would worship. It was reason. You must be reasonable. You must be controlled and virtuous. And so their virtues wouldn't be exactly the same as ours, but that was the two competing thoughts of the day. And those are the two groups that Paul encounters here. If we keep going then in verse 19, then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? So the Areopagus, it literally means the hill of Ares. And Ares was the god of war for the Greeks. If you know the god of war for the Romans, they had the same guy, they just had a different name for him. It was Mars. So if you've ever heard of Mars Hill, that's this place. And some of your Bibles may say that, others will have Areopagus. This is Mars Hill. So all those things in the churches, I don't know, I grew up out in the country, there were a couple of churches around me that were the Mars Hill Church or whatever. So this is where they get that name. It's from this event right here. And this Areopagus is where the city council met. And so it kind of waxed and waned in its power over the years, but right now it's the ruling body in the city of Athens under Roman authority, of course. If we keep going, you are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who live there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. And when I read that this week, the first thing I thought of was social media and the 24-hour news cycle. I can't go almost anywhere without seeing this stuff bombarding me all the time. What's the latest thing? And by the way, what does everyone have to say about it? It's amazing to me that a city in the ancient Near East could be so wealthy and so self-sufficient. I mean, this is a time when most people were living kind of hand to mouth, right? Much more so than we are today. But they were so wealthy back then, they could spend hours a day, every day, just debating useless philosophies. And it sounds so much like America, doesn't it? So I'm beginning to resonate with my Athenian culture. So then Paul stood up in the Areopagus, and he says, men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. I don't think that was a compliment from Paul. They may have viewed it as one. I'm not sure. They kind of also at times thought it was not a good thing to be so religious. But again, I look at our culture and I think about how much we worship. And I'm blown away, and I'm appalled. We just ended a season of March Madness. It was a very depressing time because UK lost in the Sweet 16. But, I mean, every time that time of year comes along, or every time it's the Super Bowl, or every time there's the NBA Finals, it hits me how much we worship this stuff. True and I went to a concert a couple of weeks ago. It's like the third concert we've attended ever. It feels like that anyway, but it was a good one. It was the Eagles. That's something that's been on our bucket list since before we were married. We were talking about it. And so we finally mortgaged the house and bought a couple of tickets. It was amazing. I mean, I didn't realize how talented Joe Walsh is. The guy's completely insane, but he's really gifted as a musician. But here's what hit me, and it hits me every time I go to something like that too. There's a reason that Steve Tyler from Aerosmith refers to himself and others like him as rock gods. There's a reason they do that. And I don't know if it ever hits you in the gut when you're listening to someone like that, but it hits me when I see how we respond to them as a people, and I think, wow, America, you are a very worshipful people. We even have a show we call American Idol. Well, let's keep going. Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now what you worship is something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it as the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands, and he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out to him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. This sermon that Paul gives, it's been widely criticized. The reaction that he got the day of wasn't exactly glowing. And even 2,000 years later, I think this is probably the one that Paul is criticized for the most. The critics usually fall in one of two camps. So on the one hand, there are a lot of people who say it wasn't even Paul's. They look at the language, the style, what he leaves out, what he puts in, and they think, this is so unlike Paul, it couldn't have been Paul. This is somebody else. Some later writer attributed it to Paul decades or hundreds of years later, and now this is what we're left with. And really the basis for it, if you just flip your Bible over a few pages, we won't read it, but just Romans 1 and 2. I mean, read Romans 1 and 2 and how Paul addresses the church at Rome, and then this sermon in, you know, Romans 1 and 2 is almost like a sinners in the hands of an angry God type of intro. And this sermon here, it's not like that at all. It's very different. He brings up Greek philosophers. And it means it's nothing like what you see from Paul everywhere else. And so that left me with this question is why would Paul do that? Why would he give such a unique message to these people? It's so different than everything else we have recorded in the Bible. Yesterday, we spent most of our morning and part of the afternoon at the soccer fields behind our house. Luke was playing a game, and And then after that, Gabriel was reffing two games. And so, first of all, that was really funny because it's his first time ever reffing. So we did stay and watch, and it was these little five-year-olds. And then the second game was a bunch of four-year-olds watching him try to corral a bunch of cats. I mean, I enjoyed that thoroughly, and I think he did too, but it was pretty funny. The parents were just laughing hysterically through a lot of what went on. You know, kids are running like 30 feet out of bounds, chasing the ball as if it's still in play. He's chasing them, blowing the whistle, as are the coaches. Yeah, it was fun. But it reminded me of all the times that I've coached soccer. And I was thinking about that and how I've coached a four-year-old team on that field. It was the hardest job. Hardest job I've ever done. I still every once in a while wake up with cold sweats thinking about some of the kids on that team. Anyway, but it's so different than the older ones. Like I've also coached a middle school team, helped coach one of those. And you know what I was thinking was when I read this text and I heard about some of those critics and I thought about what I did, I'm thinking if you put my practice plan for my four-year-old soccer team down next to my practice plan for my middle school soccer team, not only would you think it's a completely different coach who wrote the plan and is implementing the plan, you might not even think it's the same sport. Because what I was doing with the four-year-olds, let's not touch the ball with our hands. Let's play a game and have fun. Let's stay inside the lines. And then, okay, we're gonna play red light, green light, because that's really all you want to do anyway. Very different experience. But it didn't have anything to do with me being a different person. You know, I've done a lot of teaching at church too. I mean, I've taught senior adults. I've taught seniors in high school, junior high boys, young marrieds, adults with teens, elementary school. My approach, my lesson, my vocabulary, what I do changes radically based on who I'm talking to. If I'm talking to someone who's not a believer, I don't start with the premise that this is the authoritative word of God because they don't believe that. So it really kind of struck me as bizarre that these scholars would criticize this passage and say that Paul couldn't do the same thing. That this guy who most of what we have in the New Testament, he's writing to the church. A young church, but it's an established church. They held to the authority of the Bible, the Old Testament, and the teaching of the apostles. They had a different starting point. And so when Paul comes to this group, though, this group has none of that. They don't know anything about Judaism. They don't know anything about Christianity. But they do know about Greek philosophy. And so Paul starts there. That's one criticism. The second criticism that you hear about this sermon is actually on the exact opposite end of the spectrum. It's not liberal theologians saying that this isn't even Paul because it's different than what we expect from Paul. The other side of it is on the conservative side, and that one is saying this isn't good because he didn't talk about the cross, because he didn't say enough about Jesus, because he didn't mention sin. So let's start with, I want to dig into this one a little more. Let's dig into some of what Paul does in this. When he starts this, he starts with this altar to the unknown God. And so this is something I've been reading about a little bit this week. There was this biographer, Diogenes, second century AD. He wrote a biography of all the old Greek philosophers. And his works are basically the foundation of what we know about those guys. And he tells this story. In about the 6th century BC in Athens, there was this terrible plague that was sweeping through the city. The elders of the city, they believed that they were under some kind of curse. They had prayed to their gods and all the many gods that they had around them, and nothing was getting better. They weren't able to remove the curse. They couldn't even determine where it came from. So they went to the oracle at Delphi. And the advice they got there was that they should go to the island of Crete and get this guy named Epimenides. Now, Epimenides was a philosopher, and he was also a prophet. And so when Epimenides comes to Athens, he too, like Paul, is amazed by all the gods that they've got there. He's kind of blown away by it as well. But he says, you know, I think the problem is there's another god you don't know. And then if we're going to remove this plague, you have to appease him. And so the elders understandably said, how can we call out to this god if we don't even know his name? And so Epimenides responds and says, if I believe this god, if he's good enough to want to remove the curse, and if he's great enough to remove the curse, he will also be good enough and great enough to forgive you of your ignorance if you just acknowledge it and call on him anyway. So here's my idea. We'll take some sheep right out of the pen in the morning. They've not eaten all night. They're hungry. Let's release them on Mars Hill. And so if some of these sheep, instead of grazing, lie down, then that will tell us that this unknown God has selected that sheep for sacrifice. He's acknowledged our request. And what we'll do is on that very spot, we'll build an altar and we'll sacrifice the sheep on it. And the inscription on the altar is going to be Agnostu Deo, the unknown God. And so that's what they did. And there were quite a few sheep, as the story goes, that did this. And so there were multiple altars to the unknown God on Mars Hill and around the city, because some of them also scattered. And so when Paul shows up 600 years later, at least some of them are still around. I mean, this one here is actually in a museum. It wasn't in Athens, but it was not far from it. And it says on the side of it, I can't read it, but it does say on the side of it, to the unknown God, the little plaque there. So, Paul, one other thing, if you've got an NIV, a new one, if you look down in your notes, you may have a footnote that says, that references this quote, a quote in here, to Epimenides. So Paul, he shows up and he says, I'm not advocating a foreign god. I'm actually advocating the God who saved your city. The one that you kind of know, but you don't really know. And then he quotes Epimenides by saying about this chief God, it is in him we live and move and have our being. I don't know if you knew where that came from. That's where that came from. Paul goes on from there and he quotes another Greek philosopher, this time one of the Stoics. So the guys that he referenced earlier is running into. And in this one, he refers to how we are the offspring of this chief God. And that statement then becomes the basis for the rest of what Paul says to the folks there in Athens. So this critique of the sermon, that it's too philosophical and there's not enough about Jesus or the cross, it also claims one more thing, and that is that it didn't really yield that much in the way of results. There's no mention in the New Testament after this of this great church in Athens or any letter written to them. There's no first and second Athens that we study. There's no record of anybody else going back there or people coming from there. So the argument goes that since Paul didn't preach the cross and that we have no record of a great church being founded there, that he learned his lesson. And from this point forward, he criticized relying on human knowledge. And if you look in 1 Corinthians, you'll see just a few pages over, he goes on for a bit about that. And he says, I knew nothing, you know, when he came to Corinth, and in the text, in chapter 18, the place he leaves Athens for is Corinth. And he says about being in Corinth later, when he writes the letter to the first Corinthians, what we call 1 Corinthians, he says, I profess to know nothing except Christ and him crucified. And he goes to great lengths to kind of discredit human knowledge. So you're probably going to be surprised that I think that that critique isn't very good either. A few weeks ago, we went to Washington, D.C. One of the things we did while we were there is we went to the Museum of the Bible. It just opened in November, so I don't know if I've told you about it before, or any of you, but it was really a cool place to go. We got to see fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is kind of something that I'm kind of interested in. There's a reproduction of the Isaiah scroll, which is an amazing thing to me. I don't know what you know about that, but it's basically this one document we found that took biblical scholarship where it was going off the rails in a horrible way. This document blew it completely to smithereens because we found a copy of the entire book of Isaiah that's written 150 years before Jesus was born that prophesies about Jesus. To me, that's really cool. I'm a little bit of a history and archaeology nerd. So we got to see some of that stuff. That was amazing. But one of the things that the boys were really impressed by as we left, we asked them what they liked or what was impressive to them, and they said it was the translation room. And so there was this room where it was a pretty good-sized room, and it was bookshelves, floor to ceiling, and it was copies of the Bible. And what it was is there are about 4,000 languages that are used by like 99% of the population. There's like 7,000 total, but about 4,000 that people use. And so this room showed how the Bible was translated. And if there was one book on these shelves for every one of those 4,000 languages. If the Bible had been completely translated into that language, it was dark brown. If the New Testament was done and only part of the Old, but it was in progress, it would be a lighter shade of brown. You know, if it was only the New, it would be almost a tan. And it kept going down to bright yellow, and bright yellow was, we haven't even started. What was an eye-opener for us is that half the books in the room were bright yellow. I didn't know that. I thought we were farther along than we are. We've got decades of translation work. But what it highlights is the first thing we do when we try to go to a new culture, a new nation, is we translate the Bible into that language. It's not really what other religious groups do. I mean, if you want to become a Muslim and you want to read the Quran, at some point you need to learn Arabic so you can read it in the original language. There are English translations, but you need to read it in the original. We don't teach people Greek and Hebrew so they can read the Bible. I love that about our faith. We translate it into your language. I have another story about the Bible, not this literal one, but about the NIV. When I was a kid growing up in Kentucky, I'm from a town of about 500 people. We have a traffic light. It's one of those that's yellow on one side and red on the other. Because the highway at the edge of town, they just slow down when they come by. The church that I grew up at, there were about 110 members. Almost everybody there either was a farmer or grew up as a farmer. In about 1981, one of our deacons found an NIV, and he came to the elders, and he said, can we start using this in church? Because for the first time in my life, I can read this book, and I understand it. Everything I'd ever used was King James at the time. That's what all we ever used. That was the job of the preacher, was to translate King James into English so we could understand it. And I remember my dad telling this man, you know, we're not going to have some big debate or decision to go officially this way or that way. How about this? I think, you know, we had pews, we had shelves in the back. I think if someone just bought a couple of boxes of those, stuck them in the back of the pews, I don't think anybody'd care. He was right. They showed up a few weeks later. What's this? There we go. The big decision that was made was, we had a scripture reading every Sunday, that for those of us who were doing it, we were asked, hey, when you read, before you start, tell us what you're going to read, but then tell us what translation you're using. That's it. That was the decision. Just tell us what you're going to use. So people wouldn't be lost. I remember talking to an elder from our church then. His name was Garland Rush. He was about my grandparents' age. He's long gone now. Garland, I don't think he finished high school. He was a farmer, been a farmer his whole life. But he knew the Bible. He knew the Word, and he knew it a lot better than I do. The only Bible he'd ever known was King James. And I remember the two of us talking off to the side one day in the back of the church, and he said, you know, I really don't like this NIV. I just don't like it. All I've ever known is this. Garland had a big family. He had a lot of kids, and he had a whole lot more grandkids. He said, but if people, especially young people, can understand it better, I guess I'm okay with it. My respect for that man just went through there. I didn't even want I'll tell you, I was in the King James camp back then. I was like, no, I don't like it either. I think this one sounds better. The King James sounds better. But my respect for him went through the roof, and it still is, and I'll never forget that story. Let's go back to Paul again. That is the message and the approach that Paul takes. When he was criticizing those who boast in human knowledge, I don't think he was meaning we should never use it for anything. And the reason I think that is if you go just a few chapters over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, starting in verse 19. Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. The last story I want to tell you. When we were in Tennessee, again, small town, 20,000 people, I was talking to one of our elders about what we did on Sunday mornings and how things went. And I remember this conversation where similar. I mean, LV graduated from high school, but he'd never gone to college, wasn't a highly educated man, but he was a very intelligent man, a very thoughtful man, self-educated man. And he said, you know, David, I hate opera music. I hate it. There's probably nothing I would not want to hear more than that. Nothing. But if next year youth in America embraces opera music, I don't think it's likely. But if it happens, and we think that by using opera music, we can reach out to people who aren't saved, especially young people, we will spend our money training, writing new songs, and I'll run the soundboard just like I do now, even if I have to wear earplugs. We will do opera music if it reaches the lost. So my question to you is, how far would you go to save one soul? What lengths would you go to reach the lost? You don't have to travel across the world for this question. They're right here in Reynoldsburg. How uncomfortable are you willing to be for the mission of making disciples here in Reynoldsburg? This attitude of becoming all things to all men so that I might save some. That's the same attitude that farmer elder had about the NIV. It's the same attitude that the elder in Tennessee had about opera music. It's the attitude I have. If tomorrow we realize that, you know what, no one's speaking English anymore, we need to all learn Spanish, then I'm going to say every one of us needs to put Duolingo on our phones and we need to start learning Spanish so that we can speak to the people who are here. If whatever I can do to make myself a minority here, I'm in. Because there are a lot of times when we get together when I'm one of the youngest people in the room. I don't like that trajectory. I don't know about you, but I'm willing to change a lot. And how much are you willing to change to reach a lost next generation? As the worship team comes up, I want you to think about if there's some person that you want to reach, if there's some person that you want us to be praying for, if you want to come forward and tell us, we'll pray for that individual and for you as you reach out to them. If there's something that is on your heart, some concern you've got and you want this body to be wrapping our arms around you in prayer, we will do that now. And if you're someone who's never made a commitment to Christ, then we ask that you come forward right now as we stand and sing.